Hi, and welcome back to The Growth System, the podcast that looks at B2B growth through a systems thinking lens. I'm Colin Shakespeare.
And I'm Chris Bayliss.
And today, we're going to move on with our exploration of the growth team operating system and the different dimensions. And today, really getting into, I think, the practical backbone of how we get work done, the sort of daily routines and processes that sort of keep your growth system engine humming along. And that's what we call workflows. So sort of, Chris, I think we all really know, it probably goes without saying, that sort of getting this right workflows, or you might say processes, is important. But I think typically at RevSpace, when we start to work with organizations, it's hard to think of any that are really in a good place. I think not just in my experience at RevSpace, but I think throughout my career, it's hard to think of an organization I've gone into where workflows are essentially in a good place when it comes to being well documented and well embedded, and I guess working as a whole system across the whole enterprise. Why is that, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because when we talk about processes not being in a great place or documentation not being in a good place, certainly, in reality, that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't documented processes. It just certainly means that the majority of the time, they don't actually represent the reality of how work gets done. And the reasons for this, I think you could probably view in systems thinking terms, because workflows can be viewed as what we might call the sort of socio-technical fabric of the business. And what I mean by that is they are the intersection point of kind of human interaction, technology, and to a significant extent, organizational culture, all woven together into, you know, how we do things around here, how this thing happens within the organization. So they're sort of an intertwined ecosystem of daily operations. And to work effectively, all of these elements have to be well aligned. So, you know, people need to understand their roles. The tech stack needs to be integrated. The culture needs to sort of support not just something like continuous learning, but actually it needs to support even having a culture that follows processes, that doesn't cut corners, that, you know, depends on documentation. Actually, that sort of cultural view of actually how we do things is key. And when you do get it right, you get a sort of self-reinforcing cycle of efficiency, you know, collaboration maybe. But in reality, it's documenting all of those things is bloody difficult. You know, you're not likely to get that in a nice AI process flow of, you know, how to do this thing. So, and to be fair, neither do you have to have, you know, how culture supports processes as part of your process documentation. That would be somewhat overblown. But actually, the fact that it exists and it is a component there means that it has a significant bias on how things actually get done. So that is the problem that we see, is that someone might put a process in a drawer if it's a key thing, and no one will reference it, and the culture probably isn't that we have to be, you know, that specific, you know, we're perhaps not in a regulatory environment, and therefore things just evolve and they adapt. And you could say, to a certain extent, so should they, but then this doesn't get reflected back, and therefore you don't have this ability to transfer the knowledge, you know, things get learned by rote. And that is problematic. Certainly, it's problematic from the view of the system designer. So, yeah, I think really, in a nutshell, it's, you know, there is a complexity in how you actually document something that is that multifaceted. And I think the sort of related issue, if you like, is that it's really, really easy to see workflow design, process design as a static exercise. So systems are really just, well, one of the definitions of a system is a process and an operand. So processes really are integral to systems. And as we've talked about many, many times before, businesses are complex adaptive systems. So they respond and change over time to signals, they change to feedback, they change to system constraints, and they form their own sort of patterns of emergent behavior, something we've talked about a lot, sort of emergence. And again, this sort of adaptive nature combined with the sort of multifaceted nature of what they are in the first place means that they are inherently kind of organic. They don't really lend themselves to being written down. So there is a sort of paradox, I guess, with processes that mean that something that really needs to be written down is almost impossible to do so in an up-to-the-minute way. Which maybe we could just end the episode there, yeah.
Short episode this week, guys. So I guess then we have to sort of think about where we, as you seem to say every day, think about where we draw the system boundary to make sure that we kind of are at least giving some shape to the problem, something so we know where to start effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the sort of local to global relationship of kind of processes is integral to the work that we do. Because, you know, if we have a sales process, you know, probably the most common process that's in any organization, and almost every organization will have their sales process written down in some way, shape, or form. But it is inherently something with like a sales process and inherently have a very, very tight boundary. How do sellers use the CRM to document and manage how they engage with prospects and turn them into customers? And for anyone that's written a sales process, that feels probably complex enough just to get that right. But of course, that very local view, that tight system boundary, has a huge global impact across the organization. There are so many interfacing teams that kind of touch a sales process or are impacted by a sales process. You know, how marketing hand off leads, you know, that is a sort of interface point, I guess, with a different set of processes. But more so than just the interface, you know, what is coming through that interface? Does that actually support the sales process? Is sales getting what they need from marketing? You know, how are we onboarding? How are we giving visibility to delivery teams? You know, how are we engaging pre-sales if you have that? How are we scheduling resource downstream? Are we actually getting the right fit customers through that don't churn, that don't impact our numbers later? You know, I could go on and on and on, but fundamentally the sales process is the linchpin to a great many things, and yet it's inherently a very local process. So I think recognizing that kind of upstream and downstream effects, you know, that's a really, really critical component of effective kind of workflow design.
I've noticed particularly in sort of early stage sort of SaaS startups that I've been involved with, where in that early kind of grow at all costs or at least grow rapidly phase, the sales process or sales processes even tend to kind of bend around whatever it takes to secure the account that you want. And what you end up as you get to that point where the organization is trying to scale is that you have a lot of very sort of disjointed processes that are essentially unique to each account, and that's kind of grown out of essentially some fairly ad hoc sales processes at the kind of start of the company, and this is having this ripple effect that essentially is a problem that needs to be solved before the organization can really scale effectively. So it's something that I've, I guess, kind of seen firsthand. I'm also thinking about, well, yeah, I'm kind of understanding the big picture here, but I'm thinking, if this is me at my own company, and I was listening to this and thinking, great, my next question would be, where do I actually start? Like, where do you sort of identify, or how do you identify the biggest sort of friction points that prevent that sort of alignment of daily workflows between, say, for example, different teams? Like, in my experience, the friction points have been around the sales process, but maybe when it comes to handing over to success or account management teams, or actually when there's been some, you know, internal churn, like an account manager's changing or something like that as well. But yeah, where do you see these sort of friction points and sort of ways to diagnose, I guess, where to start, the problems and where to start?
Well, I think, you know, it wasn't what I was planning to say, but you just sort of say, oh, when an account manager leaves, and And, you know, my God, is that when you know how good your processes are, when you have that sort of linchpin person in one team or one part of the organization leaves and everything, you know, is humming around them properly. You don't think about that part of the org. They're high performing. And then suddenly one person leaves and the whole house of cards falls over. And that's when you know when you've got it wrong, because it was just all... you just had a single point of failure within the organization, and that all of that sort of, you know, inherent understanding of how to get things done leaves with the individual. And that's obviously a disaster. You know, that's a risk factor that needs to be identified. And it's a really key thing, I think, in understanding, okay, well, how do you do things properly? But ultimately, I guess more broadly, and that's probably to more specifically answer your question, The one big pitfall that we always see is that even in organizations that consider themselves to be quite good at processes, standard operating procedures, whatever they might want to call them, they get created in silos. You know, silos. We bang on about it all the time. But of course, it's just pervasive. You know, if you have an organization that promotes silos, everything is in silos. You know, technology is in silos, processes are in silos, targets and goals are in silos, all the stuff we talk about. And, you know, you feel it, because everybody does a good job at doing what they think's right, you know, within the sort of walls of their own castle. And it's only when you look at processes that have global effect, like anything that touches a customer, which in, you know, certainly for the listeners of this podcast will be almost everything. That's when you have problems, because you're not designing interfaces. You don't have that 360 understanding of what else is going on. You don't know what data is being captured. And sure, you might have an alignment meeting, or you might, you know, talk about a handoff, or you might spend an hour, you know, working out who needs what from where. But that's not the same as having a truly unified understanding of the customer experience and actually designing an end-to-end process. And that is really our rallying cry always, is just, you know, break down the walls, because everything good comes when you do that.
Yeah, so what I was hoping to get into in a little bit, I think I perhaps derailed us a little bit there, but what I was kind of hoping to get into was about... more about the sort of diagnosis area, like how do we know where these friction points are, and where we have and identify and prioritize leverage points where we can actually do something about this. Mm-hmm. Presuming we're not just starting a sort of greenfield startup where we can design this from the ground up. Typically, we're going into an organization where the situation, as you described, is the norm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's really when we get into the type of stuff that we spend a lot of our days doing. And the first step, I think, in discovery, certainly when it comes to workflow design, but I think more broadly speaking, everything that relates to the sort of formation and of a system and ultimately therefore the you know, optimization of a system, is what we call as-is mapping, as I'm sure most people call as-is mapping. And really that is, you know, that is the Ron seal of project stage names. You know, it is getting in and just working out what's going on now. And in most cases, putting it down on a piece of paper for the first time. And that's a really, really interesting part of the journey, because it is at that point when actually you don't need us. You don't need some hotshot consultancy to tell you what's going wrong. You just stick it down a big bit of paper and you're like, oh, well, that doesn't work, does it? And it's pretty bleedingly obvious, you know, that you know, when you've done these, you know, five steps and actually they don't line up at all, and you're asking different things to the same people, or worse, you're asking the same thing to the same people over and over again, or you're not capturing key bits of information, or, you know, you're making assumptions based on something that could have been, you know, declared earlier on. And it's all just fairly obvious at that point. Not always, and not always in its entirety. And what to do about it is something else. But actually the problems tend to present themselves quite clearly when you get into that sort of putting it down, that as-is mapping phase. And what is really key in that particular phase is not putting on a big chart what is on the random bits of paper and in the files and folders that, you know, bats fly out of when you open them. It is understanding what is actually going on in the organization. It is mapping the real on the ground reality of how that process happens within the organization. So we do that by interviewing individual sort of teams, small teams of the org, kind of collecting that together and going through an exercise and really drilling down and making them tell you what happens, not refer you to a document, and actually mapping that in front of them and doing that on a board or on a wall or a whatever, a Miro increasingly these days. And, you know, that's really interesting typically because you tend to then see, as I say, what's going on in a way that is not been seen by anyone in that organization before. Felt, yes, you know, everyone puts it down there, oh yeah, well that's why that's always difficult, that's why that always takes age or whatever it might be. But you undercover the real process, and you do that by interviewing frontline employees, you know, if necessary, shadowing them, not something that we tend to do a lot, but I can certainly see scenarios where that might be the most appropriate way of doing it. And you can at that point do an alignment check, you know, how many of those bits were documented and how far off the existing documentation that the business thought that it was running to, you know, what is the sort of divergence from that? And you can then see, as I said, the main friction points pretty clearly. You know, you can see that, you know, is marketing handing stuff over, you know, that it thinks is qualified, that's actually nothing of the sort. You know, is there a huge backlogs building up in kind of, you know, MQL processing in sales? You know, is stuff when that's handed over to delivery, you know, are they having to basically go through an onboarding questionnaire that re-asks every single thing that they've already told the, you know, the AE during the sales process because it just wasn't adequately written down anywhere, or it wasn't integrated from CRM into the, you know, job management system or whatever it is that you're doing or whatever your business is. And I guess really the sort of the key insight here is that undocumented processes learned by rote, transferred imperfectly from person to person, tend to be the root, you know, the small signal, the quiet signal that ripples outwards to create misalignment. And you tend to be able to spot it in that as-is phase. And what you also observe doing that time and time again is that no one wants it to be like that. No one thought it was like that. Everyone thought it was fine. Everyone thought that we were okay. We thought we had good processes. But actually, when you work out what's really happening in the organization, very often it's quite far from that, you know, accepted truth. And getting people to get into that process is often the trick because they don't, you know, what do they say in Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, the first step is admitting you've got a problem. I think that's often true when it comes to process design.
I think that's one of the hard things as well for me, trying to open up conversations with revenue leaders about this sort of areas. It's the something they don't really want to generally admit that they have a problem with, even though literally all of them do. Perhaps we should just have a support group. maybe that's what we're doing now. So something that came out when you were speaking there, Chris, I was thinking about, you know, still thinking about this question of how do we prioritize, how do we figure out where the opportunities are, where the potential leverage points are, where we can make changes and positively affect things. And something that came out from what you were saying was see if you agree with this, it tends to be around the interconnections in the system. Mm-hmm. You know, like my example where, you know, it's a handover to an account manager or success or something like that. So first, kind of two-part question, I guess. Like, do you agree? Is that what you see as well? And second of all, once we've kind of identified and sort of pinpointed those areas for those leverage points for that would be good, you know, particularly impactful to try and affect, how do we actually translate that into sort of well-designed, embedded, sort of holistic workflows that will actually be sort of adopted and owned and positively impact things?
That's a big question.
Yeah, I should have broken that down actually.
Well, that's the rest of the episode, isn't it? So I think that the first part, absolutely, yeah, the interconnections tend to be where the problems are deepest and darkest because they are undocumented. The documented processes, the things that people do every day, there can be problems with them. You know, you can have that QT member leave and it all falls over, but fundamentally work is getting done. Those processes, efficiently or inefficiently, are getting the organization more or less where it needs to go most of the time when viewed in that very local, you know, that through that very local lens, through that very tight system boundary. It is only when you zoom out and see the interfaces between processes, which often are the interfaces between teams, where you realize that things are not as rosy as you would like them to be. And that is, yeah, it's such a huge issue because it's not just about how efficiently something's making it from team A to team B or from process A to process B. The inefficiency and the friction created in those interfaces are like tectonic plates. You know, they rub and they rub and they rub and then they blow up. And they deepen the silos because they drive sort of factions within the organization. You know, this isn't working because of them. You know, we do a great job and we throw it into the abyss, and when it comes out the other side, they just mess it up. And you know, I think that is so common that these kind of small points of friction can explode into far bigger issues that go far beyond the, you know, the measured efficiency of, you know, one data point, whether that is a customer or, you know, a whatever, traveling from process A to process B. So definitely interfaces, interconnections are the problem in a great many cases. What do we do about that? I think was probably the second part of the question. You know, that's an interesting one. You know, when we see inefficiencies, you know, the sort of impulse that you've got is then to just immediately plug them and to do things like chuck automation at them or to build integrations. And I get it. You know, we have an automation and practice within our organization. I am a great believer in integration and automation and the sort of democratization of those tools within the org. However, the problem of just doing that is that you tend to just mechanize an inefficient process. And when you look at, and I sort of perhaps talk about this more broadly than just process design and actually talk about automation design, is it's really, really easy to say, okay, well, actually, everything works fine up to point C, and then, you know, something goes wrong between C and D, or a person is manually doing something between C and D, so let's just integrate point C and D, and then everything will be great. And actually, you then lose the opportunity to optimize the entire process, to actually look at the underlying structure of the process itself and understand what is broken, what is unnecessary, you know, what is a symptom of a system we had 10 years ago and actually don't have anymore, but we still do things in that way, or whatever silly thing it is that tends to just happen because no one's documented it, so no one's really thought about it. So you really risk scaling the dysfunction. You know, you add a point of failure. You sort of, we've talked a lot about fragility in the last couple of episodes, and if you do that, you just kind of bridge the gap. Then you just entrench the problem, and you make it harder to fix later because there's a perception that it has been fixed, and therefore the budget and the time and the effort is not released by the organization again to relook at it. So I think that my generic answer, and I think we'll go into some more detailed answers as we go, is actually to look at the whole thing holistically. And to not have anything off the table when it comes to how you might reinvent it.
I wonder to what extent you think that this phase where we're sort of designing the 2B state, where we there is a risk of planning something that's maybe unachievable. Like there's a potential for a gap between strategy and reality, effectively. Mm-hmm. And it might be worth sort of saying a bit about how we manage that and sort of minimize that gap, I guess.
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting point, because when you get into an exercise like this, the temptation is to want the best possible workflow that is possible to imagine. And very often that's not as simple as just saying, okay, well, you know, we're going to put something in a process flow and these four team members are going to follow it. It typically means we're going to embed some tooling, we're going to buy some software, we're going to integrate that software better, we're going to onboard an iPaaS tool to stitch it all together, we're going to drive automation, we're going to do whatever it is. But essentially, these sort of projects tend to have a sort of technical component to them. And then you are at risk of getting that sort of, aspiration to reality gap showing itself, because it's easy, if you're not careful, to build something that is over-engineered, that is unmaintainable, that is not understood by the people on the ground, that creates a sort of black box, even if you build the box. And it often depends a lot on engineering resource, and therefore it really, really depends on having established a really deep understanding of the problem at a sort of domain expertise level to then bake something in. If you haven't done that, then what you can do is spend a lot of time and money baking in a process that's no good, that no one knows how to change or to fix, because you spent a lot of money with an engineering consultancy. So I think that really the first step is making sure that you are really, really clear on what you are trying to achieve, and crucially, not just what you're trying to achieve at a local level, but what you're trying to achieve at a global level. So, you know, we're believers certainly in kind of trying to align everything we're doing around system design to the sort of purpose of the organization and to those sort of North Star metric or metrics that you might have established as part of the overall project flow. And, you know, if you are prioritizing, you know, a certain number of, let's say, meetings booked within a quarter and you're looking at the sales process maybe, then you're going to want to make sure that whatever you build is actually going to align to that objective. So you need to be looking more broadly about, okay, well, how is data flowing into the system? You know, how many, how much in the way of like content follow-ups and sort of ebook downloads is the sales team having to do? What are the processes for doing that? You know, how much of that is automated? What messaging are we using? How are we asking people to do stuff? Do we have multiple workflows happening at the same time where, you know, we've got maybe an inbound stream, but we've also got a higher intent stream. We've maybe got an outbound stream. We've got an ABM focus stream, whatever it might be. But, you know, how are you prioritizing? Is that actually getting you where you need to go? If we're building a sort of process for growth, if you like, we're building a sort of strategy which has a lot of processes wrapped up into it. You know, how are we managing inbound leads? How are we managing the SDR team? How are we remunerating them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Does that actually get us where we need to go? And it's very, very difficult to sometimes, when you're down in the weeds of trying to build processes, to actually pop up and helicopter out and say, are we actually still traveling in the right direction? So aligning things to the sort of North Star of what the organization's actually trying to achieve is really key when we're getting into that sort of 2B piece. Is this actually serving the purpose that we intended it to serve? And I think that when we're kind of looking at particularly sort of bridging that sort of strategy to reality gap, feasibility, of course, is a big part of that. So once we've orientated it towards, is it going where we actually want it to go, then are we actually designing something? You know, are we building something someone can actually drive? So getting in that sort of marketing automation process design example I was sort of laboring for a moment ago, well, actually, if we're like, okay, well, to enable us to do that, then we need to get an intent tool in, and maybe we were going to buy Bombora, and we need a LinkedIn automation tool, and we need that to integrate with our CRM, and we've got, I don't know, HubSpot Sales Enterprise, so we've got our sequence automation in there, and we're using Cognizm for our data, and then, you know, and actually at this point, well, A, can we afford all these many pieces of SaaS? Do we actually have the capability to effectively integrate them? Do we have a well enough optimized view of how we're actually winning? And what I mean by that is, it's all well and good sticking something down on paper about what your process is going to be, but if you don't know it's actually going to work, then don't spend a whole bunch of time and money automating that to death and getting everything stitched together, only to realize that actually it was a stupid plan in the first place. So, you know, are we actually building something that is already proven to work? And, you know, I think that sort of resource, reality, technology, staff skill sets, budgets, you know, whatever they might be, does that actually work? A big one that actually I haven't mentioned, which I would say is the most overlooked and most impactful sort of strategy to reality gap, is, do we actually have time to do this thing that we've designed? Because and you know, therefore, have you actually told everyone that was already really busy before you've built this thing what they're not going to be doing anymore?
Well, this is what's going to get to the actual people who execute that. You know, I've more often been on the side where, you know, everyone's executing the particular processes every day at work, right? So, like everyone, I've been more involved in that actual execution, daily execution, than the process design phase. And I've seen some initiatives around designing new processes that are very well intentioned fail because there's just not the buy-in from the stakeholders, the people who actually execute the process daily. You just sort of hear on the grapevine that we're doing things a different way, and everyone's got a different sort of, there's an inconsistency in the messaging. Like, nobody's quite sure how we do the new process or exactly what it is that we don't do anymore. And, yeah, you know, it's not really been, we haven't had that sort of collaborative workshop part of the process, I guess, where we're sort of, all agreeing on who's responsible for what now and what's going to change, and crucially what we're not going to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the biggest source of friction and finger pointing and general failure of these sorts of initiatives that I've seen.
Yes, absolutely. I saw a really good one quite recently. It was with a customer, but I won't name any names, but they developed a new onboarding program for their customers, and they really wanted to prioritize essentially they were trying to get great reviews. They were trying to build advocacy within their customers. They really wanted to take care of people through the onboarding process to their product. And it was all made so much sense on paper. And they put together this kind of intensive 30-day plan where, you know, essentially someone was going to have their hand held through the entire onboarding process. And then at the end, they were like, okay, so how many new customers are we onboarding? How many hours is that going to be every week? And they hadn't actually quite figured out that the one person they had working in success wasn't actually going to be able to do this. And you were like, okay. So, you know, great idea, great execution to the extent that it was a beautifully put together plan, you know, on point in terms of the, you know, alignment to their North Star metric and wanting to deliver incredible customer experiences and get people to get value from their product really quickly and get, you know, get really fast time to first value. Fell at the last hurdle, which is they couldn't actually roll it out until they hired some people. And, you know, that therefore that sort of quite boring resource alignment piece we were just talking about, strategy to reality gap, you know, it's out there in real life and it's waiting to bite you if you don't get it right.
So I think this attention here as well, just to kind of, I think we could probably get bogged down in amusing anecdotes about, or perhaps not so amusing anecdotes about this going wrong, right? Now, I think there's a tension between taking a holistic view, which of course as systems thinkers we obviously have to do, that sort of comes with the territory, and the fact that we maybe can't transform every process across the whole enterprise in one go. We have to zoom in on an area, create a sort of controlled group, if you like, to focus on a specific product line or function or a specific region, and kind of sort of test and learn from what we're doing there. I think that I've also seen efforts at sort of big bang transformation, which again, typically, perhaps less often, but typically sort of failing, and perhaps there's an issue of the kind of the scale and scope. So there's a sort of tension between being holistic and yet needing to find a specific area to focus on, really, to make it achievable and achievable and deliverable, and something that you could actually give yourself sort of time to analyze and learn from.
Absolutely. I think this kind of is such a sort of cautionary tale, really, because it's so tempting when you've designed the, you know, the shiny new thing that you just want everyone to use it straight away, and like, why are we doing the old thing, you know, bang, let's just get everyone going. And I remember speaking to someone that actually runs another consultancy, and they had a very, very large technology client, you know, sort of, well, maybe not a household name, but certainly if you work in the tech industry, someone you would instantly have heard of. And they were telling me that they'd designed a new ABM program for them. In fact, they had designed an ABM program. They weren't currently using ABM. And they had something like, I can't remember, it's probably not important for the story, but they had a couple of hundred key accounts. And they had, I think, 100 AEs, maybe a little less, but they're each running a couple of guys. They're all big seven-figure accounts. And they decided, okay, bang. And then they just decided, okay, like next Monday, we're switching ABM on and we're rolling it out across all 200 accounts, all 100 AEs, and it's just switching on. And unbelievably, they did actually make it work. And well done to my acquaintance there for actually making that happen. I think it took about 10 years off her life making it work. But you know, that is the absolute archetypal kind of example where doing a pilot is absolutely the right way to go. You know, stick it into one team, one little pod, one cluster of people, you know, a couple of accounts. Debug the process, make it work for your organization, get the comparative metrics, you know, take it as the opportunity to build the business case. Doing it the new way, you know, achieves X when continually doing it the old way only achieves Y. You know, give yourself the head of steam that you need to then do the bigger bang rollout, because it becomes easier to embed. And I think that is really the key here. Is it's not about how good your process is, and it's not about how much money you've got. It's actually, these things live and die in your ability to actually take the human beings in your organization along with you and get them to adopt it and to, you know, really embed it into their day-to-day, you know, to put it in part of their sort of mental model of how we do work. And that is the big thing. And that sort of, you know, change and adoption process, you know, training and reinforcement, call it what you will, you know, that is the true battleground in embedding new processes in you know, designing to the 2B system.
So I'm thinking about my experiences of some very well-intentioned initiatives around this in organizations I've worked for. Again, not naming any names. It's actually no point in naming names because it's actually ubiquitous as far as I can see, where a new process is kind of made official. Maybe there's some documentation. We have a training session, possibly more than one training session, possibly something recurring until everyone realizes that it's not really having the effect and gradually gets out of it. But there tends to be a culture of resistance to process adoption rather than a culture of sort of positive new process adoption, where a lot of organizations have been, and particularly this is probably biased towards sales. Sorry, guys. Nobody likes to talk about this, but where the sales process or processes that salespeople have to engage with are seen as a hindrance, almost like it's part of the game, like a blocker in your way to getting done what you need to do, i.e. selling and generating revenues. It's just like, yeah, this almost like it would be easier if it wasn't for the process as it is. You know, if you have some sort of like sort of quality control that determines whether or not that a particular sales opportunity, a deal you're working on, is the right fit for the organization, yeah. Which I guess in thinking about the whole system as a system, that makes sense. But to the salesperson, of course, they nickname that department, you know, the sales prevention unit or something like that, right? So, or do you work in sales prevention, they might say. Sometimes it might be sales ops, someone like that deals with that. So there's this view of kind of like almost like the official process is kind of like the bad guy, the man, something that you just need to work around. It's an unfortunate fact of life, rather than the sales process having the potential to be something which is a great enabler of getting done what you need to do. And I think that creating that cultural shift is quite a challenge in itself in a lot of organizations.
Definitely. You know, as you were saying there, I just Googled something because it's like getting people to break a habit. So I just Googled, yeah, how long does it actually take to break a habit? Apparently, according to Gemini, 18 to 254 days, but an average of 66. But I would say that roughly accords to kind of my experience, which is the first 90 days of rolling out something big are critical, because the first 90 days is when you get that sort of drift back happening. You get that resistance, you get that organizational inertia, and you've got to overcome it, and you've got to nail it down, you've got to do it right. And if you get through that first 90 days and people are still toeing the line, the chances are you're going to get that to work properly. But if you let it drift in the first 90 days, then you know the chances of it going up in flames are fairly considerable.
So staying the course for that 90 days, that's the challenge though, isn't it? Because there's certainly been in organizations where there's a quiet conspiracy, I would say, in some cases, to just like, if we ignore this for long enough, it will go away. And I think, you know, sorry everyone for busting out that secret. Nobody really talks about it, but that's effectively what's going on.
Absolutely. Now, we've got about 5 minutes left, maybe six if we're generous, because we promised we would come in on time to this week. So where are we going to go from here?
I think it would be good to have a talk about, and I know I keep coming back to this and trying to draw a system boundary. I'm thinking about, first of all, how do we diagnose, and select the right sort of leverage points where we can where we can positively affect things. Do you think we've said enough about automation and sort of how to strategically select targets for automation? I think you've said a little bit about what to not do.
Yeah.
Around automation. Maybe we should say a bit about what to do. And then that's probably all we've got time for, and we should probably wrap up the general theme of workflows.
Sounds good to me. I also suspect we probably do a second episode on this and still carry on talking about stuff. I don't know. Maybe we should take that offline. Maybe we should do a two-parter. But let's talk about automation, one of my favorite topics. Automation can be a great way of adding huge amounts of value into an organization. But as you say, you've got to work out where best to sort of apply the medicine, because just automating things that were rubbish in the first place and just making them, you know, rubbish but difficult to change, that is not a value add. So you've got to really consider, you know, where it's going to be a multiplier. And for me, there are a few things that you've got to look at. The first and most obvious ones, I think we have to mention, albeit I'm not actually the greatest advocate of these. So what everyone tends to look at is, where do humans add the least value? I, for which typically read, where is there a human being that is typing something from one screen into another screen? You know, where is there a piece of data that is terminating that it would be nice to be if it was somewhere else? You know, those are all good. They are often really good candidates for automation, but very, very often if the process was that rubbish in the first place, that you have got someone that's typing something from, you know, one screen into another screen, the whole process is probably ripe for reinvention. And that, I think, is a great truism that, you know, if you've got a 10-step process and you're trying to link, you know, step 7 and 8, you need to be thinking about it, you know, like the space-time continuum. You need to be thinking about processes as being bendy rather than linear. So what I mean by that is, actually, if you looked at the whole thing, and rather than going from step 1 to step 2 to step 3 to step 4 to step 5 to step 6 and then getting stuck and then having someone having to get it to step 7 and on it continues, can you actually just get it from step 1 to step 2 and then straight to step 10? Because actually you can redesign the process in such a way and leverage different tooling, you know, leverage automation in a different way that you can actually reimagine the process, not just automate the process. And I think that's a really, really key thing for me. So checking if the underlying process is poorly defined is absolutely the first thing to look at when someone says, can we just, you know, do this thing where someone's typing something in, or we've just got this kind of point of human intervention that shouldn't be there. So I think that, but that is absolutely a way of looking at it. The next thing that is generally comes to us as a need for automation, and this one typically is quite a good use case, is where have we got something that's very, very high frequency, repetitive happening that's prone to human error? So this is typically a very high value leverage point when you've got this going on, and actually not due to the high frequency and repetitive bit, is the human error bit. So we built a billing process for a customer a couple of years ago, and straight away their billings went up by about 20 to 30 grand a month. And they were like, ooh, there must be something wrong with it. Like, we're overbilling people. And actually what it turned out was, because they had a manual step before, they had a line item for account management that was on some contracts and not on others. And they had their AM team do the billing, and they basically just never added that was in the contract to anyone's bill.
So this is just revenue just leaking.
And for years and years and years.
Oh my God.
And their problem was then going back to the end user and saying, oh, we just haven't actually billed you this for the last, you know, 2 years. You did sign the contract, and that is a thing. but that, you know, that was a different problem. But you know, straight away, that human error element, because processes learned by rote. So you had two things going on there. Someone probably made an error right at the start where they hadn't read the documentation properly of however their manual process worked. And then they hadn't added the line, and then they just done it from memory every month since then.
So there's a great case for automation. Yeah, the human in the loop is the problem there. So I guess you need to see, where do humans add the least value, or where do humans potentially subtract value? I mean, in this case, really from the bottom line. And I guess another way to think about it is, where do we really need humans in the loop?
Yeah.
And i.e. that's where we don't automate.
Yes, absolutely that. So I think that probably is about all we've got time for. I think if any episode ever deserved a two-parter, it's possibly this one. So, you know, we'll chat about that, but maybe back with more workflows next week, maybe in a future episode, we'll work it out.
I've got no doubt that we will certainly return to automation. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for. We're on a tight schedule this week, folks. So thanks very much for listening, if indeed you have listened this far. The Growth System is brought to you by RevSpace. That's us. We're a growth systems consultancy. We connect B2B organizations with the future of growth and offer consultancy, education, and applied delivery services. Please don't forget to follow and rate the podcast. Really helps us to bring the content to a wider audience. And as always, we'd really appreciate a moment of your time to tell us what you think. Thanks very much. See you next week.
Thanks for listening.